This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton. John is with Etherton & Associates. And John served on the Hill for 18 years. His last job, he was with the Senate Armed Services Committee for 14 years, and he's a acknowledged expert in all things procurement and what goes on up on the Hill. And John, actually, and I had the privilege of working with John on the SARA panel back in the 2005-2007 time frame, where we put together recommendations for OMB and for Congress on the procurement system. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger.
Well, John, we've gone through quite a momentous last year with all the continuing resolutions and the late budget and, you know, just in the stops and starts, you know, particularly for a lot of our listening audience, government contractors. But, you know, it seems like it's a broken record. It just keeps repeating itself. So let's talk a little bit about the budget first. And there, you know, can you sort of just explain to me and the audience, like, the super committee, the budget, where we are, the relationship between the fiscal year 12 process and the super committee?
Sure. I'll try to walk you through it, and feel free to stop me if I get into something that's too complicated. But basically, the where we are right now is that as a result of the debt ceiling deal that was made in August, the basic boundaries on the FY12 budget have been set, okay? And that is not a subject that the super committee really is looking at right now. Their focus is FY13 and beyond. So there isn't any reason, if you look at the numbers and what then the appropriations committees have done with the numbers, especially on the Senate side, to see any reason why they couldn't finish before the end of the year or even in the next few weeks. They have the boundaries. They have the 302B allocations by subcommittees. There are some differences between the Senate numbers and the House numbers because the House did their work before the debt ceiling deal in August, so they've got to take their numbers and make some adjustments. And the Senate may adjust their numbers, you know, somewhere to meet the House, maybe not in the middle, but at least to make some changes. But this, if you look at a normal year, prior to maybe 3 or 4 years ago, this is not anything unusual, and frankly, both sides could work a deal easily within the next 3 or 4 weeks. There's an attempt right now in the Senate to bring up the bills as sort of in groups of three. The Majority Leader Reid wants to do that this week with the first three of the bills, and hopefully start a process that will meet up with the House. Maybe they do some sort of an omnibus or whatever. But I don't think people generally understand that the super committee process is somewhat disconnected from the FY12 process because the issues in the FY12 budget essentially have been settled. So that really is the question, do they just move forward? Are there other kinds of issues that come up that preclude a final deal or cause us to have another continuing resolution after November 18th? And I think that all remains to be seen. But I think they're on a track now that if they want to finish, especially by the end of the year, that they have the basis for doing that. As far as the super committee is concerned, they're on a very fast track to do a lot of deep analytical work in a number of different areas, depending on what direction they choose to go. I mean, essentially, what they have in front of them is the potential for looking at discretionary spending on the federal level, FY13 and beyond. They also could look at changes to the tax law and basically do some revenue reform, as if they chose to do that, and also even on their portfolio, if they wanted to take advantage of it as entitlement reform. So the question is, with that menu and given the politics, what do they come up with by November 23rd
portfolio, right there. That's three big chunks, right?
It's a lot to pick and choose from. And my belief is that we're going to see a lot of focus on discretionary spending, But I think there will be some attempts to look at these other areas as well, because it's very hard to get to the target numbers simply by focusing on discretionary spending. I also don't think it's generally understood that they don't have to come up with the entire $1.2 trillion savings.
No, they can, I didn't understand
they can come up with a partial and propose that, and then the sequestration that would go into effect if they don't hit the 1.2 would only be a partial. And the sequestration does not include interest on the debt if, in fact, they essentially pay it down enough that they don't have to pay the interest on the part that they pay down. It's a little complicated, but basically by the 15th of September, they could come up with something that's a partial deal.
You mean November?
Or I'm sorry, when Congress actually votes on the final up or down vote in the middle of December, they could actually approve a partial debt proposal. And then in January, the sequestration targets would be set on an account-by-account basis based on just the difference between that and 1.2. So they have a lot to work with there. I tend to think that the folks are going to be looking at the markets and seeing what the markets are doing over the next 3 or 4 weeks. I think that will have an impact. I think there'll be a number of external things that could have an impact on the deliberations of the supercommittee. I don't have quite the pessimistic view that some do, that they won't do anything. I think, at a minimum, we'll see some sort of a partial deal, and they may actually go for the whole enchilada. I don't know.
Yeah, well, let me ask you a question, and it's sort of like the dynamics of a small group versus a big group. And is it, you know, the thought process behind here, give it to this, you know, 12 guys, right? Or, you know, 12 members of Congress, and why don't you figure out some sort of blueprint for moving forward. Does that dynamic work better? Do people sort of, you know, in a smaller group, they start to, you know, sort of understand each other's positions a little bit better because they're having to work together to a common goal versus, you know, like the whole Senate trying to debate something?
I think the real answer to that question will be the degree to which the leadership in the House and Senate on both sides will let them do their work independently. If in fact this is something where the leaders are reaching in and really trying to drive the process from the outside, I don't think that internal dynamic will work very successfully. But I think if the folks on that supercommittee are given the leeway to make some decisions and work things internally, then I think you could have a dynamic that would be a little more nuanced, a little more flexible than some of the ideological positions that people, I think, are carrying into that process. But we'll have to see how it works.
Yeah, well, you know, John, thank you for bringing me back to reality there, right? I was going down a kumbaya moment kind of thing, and you bring me back to reality. It's, you know, it's what the leadership wants to do or not do to a certain extent. So, you know, but if they do not agree, what happens then? If they get to a point where, you know, the pessimists are right and, you know, unfortunately, you're in an error on this one.
Right.
What happens?
Well, what'll happen is the sequestration will go in at $1.5 trillion. Basically, is what the target is. That process will start essentially in January. Although none of the sequestrations go into effect until a year after that, so it would essentially be January of 2013, not in January of 2012. So any number of things could happen in the year. Obviously, we'll have had a national election. People can change their minds. They can make adjustments. They can do whatever they want to the process. Congress is not bound to stick to that whole process all the way through to the end, especially over the 10-year period that the sequestration is supposed to stay in effect. But the thing I also don't think is generally understood is that the sequestration essentially goes into effect on an account-by-account basis. Even in the Department of Defense, for example, if you look at the appropriations accounts, you have something like over 70 different accounts.
Wow. And
essentially what you would do is take whatever the percentage is and actually drop each individual account. It wouldn't be possible, for example, at least initially, to buy your way out of a sequestration with some sort of a specific cut that was very large, say in one account. You'd still have to do the other account cuts. You could then move the money.
So you don't have the really flexibility.
You don't have a lot of flexibility, and I don't think people understand how hard that would be in some of the accounts, especially, for example, in defense. Some of the accounts would be excluded, some of the manpower accounts and other things. So you would really have a very concentrated effect on maybe 60 of the accounts in the budget.
Wow, that sort of does put a lot of pressure on people, right? But at the same time, it's kind of interesting, the point you made, too, that it's really they've still, I mean, I don't want to say, it almost sounds like this is a lot of pressure, and they don't reach a deal, but they still have time
to figure something
out later.
Right, exactly. I mean, you have a year until the actual mechanism starts to operate. So, and again, you have, a lot of things will be happening in that year. Look at all the things that have just happened in the last few months. So.
What would, I mean, I don't know. I wonder what the markets, how they'd react to lack of a deal. I don't know. That'd be interesting, it seems to me.
Well, I think that plus the other international financial things that are happening with Europe and some of the other, I mean, all of that.
Pushes people
at some point. But the degree to which that happens, I think, over the next few weeks is still unknown.
Okay, well, John, that's great stuff. But right now we do have to take a break. But when we return, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. And we'll be talking more about the budget, more about what's going on in the Hill. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Government year-end is fast approaching. Look to GSA Advantage and the Hahn Company now and anytime you're challenged with a compressed time frame or to do more but spend less. Now more than 400 of Hahn's newest and top models are available online and at great manufacturer direct prices. You'll find multi-purpose chairs, smart desk solutions, durable storage cabinets, contemporary conference tables, and more to fit any office need. All meet or exceed government sustainability requirements, too. To shop Hahn Direct, go to gsaadvantage.gov and type Hahn's contract number 27F, like furniture, 0015S, like Sam, in the search bar. That's 27F0015S. When you need office furniture, GSA Advantage is a quick, safe way to buy online, and Hahn lets you stretch your budget without compromising quality or style. Buy Hahn Direct. Go to gsaadvantage.gov and search contract 27F0015S today.
Have Federal News Radio headlines delivered directly to your inbox. Sign up for the Federal News Flash at federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.
Federal employees are generous people, donating tens of millions of dollars to charities every year through the combined federal campaign. And while it can be tough to choose which organization should benefit from your gift, there's only one that exclusively helps federal employees and their families: the Federal Employee Education and Assistance Fund. For over 25 years, FEA, CFC number 11185, has helped feds recover from financial emergencies and natural disasters and provided their kids with college scholarships. FEA 11185 has been the best choice for feds who want to keep their CFC donation in the family by helping colleagues across the country and around the world as they do America's business every day. In the last 25 years, FEA has helped more than 21,000 federal families with over $18 million in aid. Making your pledge to FEA 11185 today will make sure help continues to be there no matter what the coming year brings for feds. Learn more at FEA.org. That's FEEA.org.
There are barbecue double burgers with mayo and bacon and cheese. There are 60-inch HD plasmas with cinema surround and 3D. There are mandatory conference calls at 8 p.m. on Saturdays. There are really comfortable overstuffed sofas that recline and vibrate and have cup holders and coolers built right in. And there are people who will sneeze right out in the open as if their germs were made of gold and the rest of the world just can't wait to share. Rah! There are moments when it feels as if the whole world is conspiring against your health, which is why there is Kaiser Permanente. We can be a partner. We can be a friend. A voice of moderation in a world gone excess and insane. So the next time you're faced with the choice between a televised marathon of vapid vixens or the chance to get a little fresh air, visit everybodywalk.org and we'll be there to help you thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has an expansive and varied mission. What is Homeland Security's acquisition strategy? How is DHS enhancing its acquisition oversight? And what is DHS doing to better manage its resources and execute its overall mission? Join host Michael Keegan on the next Business of Government Hour as he explores these questions and so much more with Dr. Nick Nyack, Chief Procurement Officer of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security.
We live in uncertain times. More than ever, federal agencies rely on TASC to accomplish the most important missions and protect America's way of life. Few in the world can do what the experts at TASC do. Trusted partners, honest counselors, TASC's highly specialized problem solvers use rare knowledge and deep experience to provide advanced systems engineering, integration, and decision support services that the U.S. government depends on to keep the country safe and secure. TASC, working for you and the nation. TASC.com.
Retirement is expensive, but dinner won't be because it's on me. Hi, I'm Mark Tabron, host of How to Protect and Grow Your Money on Federal News Radio. Join me for an informative dinner seminar at Rips Casual Dining on October the 27th in Bowie, Maryland. We'll talk about ways to help you disaster-proof your retirement. Call 1-800-783-1564 to make a reservation. Seating is limited, so call now, 1-800-783-1564. To learn more, listen Saturday mornings at 10:30 a.m. for How to Protect and Grow Your Money on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Have you been in government contracting, procurement, or acquisition for 30 years? NCMA has. Join the National Contract Management Association for the 30th Annual Government Contract Management Conference, November 14th and 15th in Bethesda, Maryland. The conference draws more than 1,000 government contract management professionals. Hear from respected speakers such as Scott Gould, Deputy Secretary, Department of Veterans Affairs, Martha Johnson, Administrator, GSA, and Shay Assad, Director, Defense Pricing, DOD. Learn more at ncmahq.org today.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we are talking about goings-on Capitol Hill. And John, when we broke, we were talking about a little bit about the budget. And I know one thing that I think folks always think about after going through that last experience, and I mentioned a little bit at the top, like the idea of stops and starts and continuing resolutions and that whole scenario. And, you know, given what you sort of talked about in terms of where we are, FY12, and where the super committee is and all that stuff. So how will that play out again, do you think, or not? Or just what should people be thinking about there?
Well, we have to do something by November the 18th, or the government will shut down again. So I think the real question is, will Congress be in a position to have largely completed the appropriations process, either in the form of an omnibus incorporating all the appropriations bills or several series of packages, which is how the Senate looks like they want to proceed now. But if they don't succeed, and if there isn't a lot of momentum, then what Congress is going to be faced with on November 18th is another continuing resolution. The real question is, we've done one already, and there was a lot of discussion during that debate over offsets for FEMA and, you know, for some of the disaster relief funding. And that whole issue, there was some discussion about maybe the government would shut down, although I don't think that was ever a realistic possibility. It took FEMA coming forward and saying, hey, we really don't need this money as quickly as we thought, to essentially take the issue off the table and to allow the continuing resolution to go forward. The real question is, now that we're going to do the second one, if that's in fact where we end up heading, and even if it's relatively short term, I think there may be a continuing resolution on November 18th. The question is, do people try to use it as another lever to do other things and threaten a government shutdown? I tend to think that will not happen if there's some prospect of actually finishing the appropriations process in a timely fashion. But on the other hand, I recall back in August and September, people didn't feel like the first one would be controversial at all and expected it to go like clockwork and look at all the problems that we had getting it finally done. So I think that's one to watch. And I think depending on what happens at the super committee or in other places, there may be some attempt to leverage that for other purposes other than just keeping the government going.
Right. Does it make a difference as that we are marching ever closer to the election year? Does that dynamic play into
the I think the dynamic situation? After the first of the year, if the budget issues are still not resolved for FY12, then I think that becomes much more of a factor.
A possibility.
I don't see it so much as we go between now and the end of the year.
Okay. So I feel sort of okay with that.
Stay tuned,
right?
Yeah.
So now let's shift somewhat radically here, John, and talk a little bit about the Wartime Contracting Commission. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, folks on the Hill paying attention to that. And first, can you tell us a little bit what it is or what it did?
The Wartime Commission on Iraq and Afghanistan contract, and they looked, because of a number of the issues that came up through the IG reports and the GAO studies, and there were a number of press stories, they formed this commission about 3 years ago was largely through the efforts of Senator McCaskill and Senator Webb, to basically take a look at this. What they had in mind was something like a new version of the Truman Commission, which went around during the Second World War and looked at a number of different contracting issues. Mm-hmm. It had sort of a permanent standing. This actually operated in a very different way from the Truman Commission. But I think the idea was that they felt if we could go through and put some expertise on some of these issues, they could come up with a number of recommendations that would prevent some of the things from occurring in the event we have another military action where we have a large reliance on contractors for support and other kinds of issues like that. So they finished their work, did a number of hearings, did field hearings, put it out four or five interim reports, some of which Congress actually acted on. The business systems rule, for example, that was recently put out as an interim rule, was driven largely by the recommendations of the commission. It was originally focused on the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan, but basically people felt that it was a more general issue, and so they came up with a general legislation and a new regulation. So now we have their final report. It came out a month or so ago. And there are a number of things in there that that folks are now holding hearings around. It isn't clear to me that the legislation will be ready in time for anybody to do anything this year to implement it, although if in the Senate the defense authorization bill is delayed, as it appears now that it will be, at a minimum till sometime either in November or December before it gets to the floor, that may give the time for the folks who really want to try to push for an aggressive implementation of the recommendations a chance to put together a package, at least to partly implement the recommendations of the commission, and we may see that when the bill comes to the floor.
Well, just a couple, I mean, and the one I know folks have talked a lot about is the sort of the recommendations and findings around suspension and debarment.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, there was some concern expressed by the commission in the report, not only in this report but in other reports, in their interims, that the agencies did not have an effective tool with suspension and debarment. That there were limitations because of a number of the due process requirements, and also the fact that the agencies have been applying suspension and debarment basically in a very inconsistent way. In fact, there was a hearing on it, I believe, last week where they looked at, I think it was Health and Human Services, and said over the course of 3 years or something, there were none, even though there were a lot of money that was going out of the agency. So I think there's going to be an effort to try to look at that and see if the process needs to be tightened up. And some people have concerns in my world, in the industry world, about the what people perceive as a negative impact of too much due process. And I think that will be another area that people are going to be looking at. I don't know if that results in anything significantly happening this year, but I know that is an area of concern.
And I don't know, just on I don't know, did the commission also make a recommendation about a standing IG?
Right.
And I know there's a bill on the Hill to do that, to quote, sort of oversee contractors in war zones.
Right.
What are the prospects for
that? Well, I think there'll be a lot of interest in it. I think the real question will be, do we need to create a new organization, since we're now in the process of pulling out of some of these commitments, that would have a life of its own beyond that point?
Right, with no combat zones, right? Who would you be overseeing?
Who are you going to be overseeing? I mean, I think I understand the rationale for it, which is that to appoint a special IG once you're actually in a war zone is a little bit after the fact, and it doesn't really allow you to set up the framework to do proper oversight. You're sort of pretty far down the road when that actually happens. I understand that. But the other issue that you get into in the whole acquisition area, and it's not only here, is you only have so many people with so much time and attention. And so you really have to, especially as procurements become more and more complex, we're striving to do more and more competitive procurements, more and more fixed price types of contracts, where you really need to make sure that you have all of your requirements figured out and a number of other things.
Absolutely.
I mean, how do you distribute the limited folks that you have to do all that in a way that really makes sense? And I think that will be an issue if people really seriously talk about institutionalizing a wartime IG like that.
John, we'll take a break, but when we return, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton Associates, and we're talking about what the goings-on on Capitol Hill and acquisition. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Government year-end is fast approaching. Look to GSA Advantage and the Han Company now and anytime you're challenged with a compressed time frame or to do more but spend less.
Now more than 400 of Hahn's newest and top models are available online and at great manufacturer direct prices. You'll find multi-purpose chairs, smart desk solutions, durable storage cabinets, contemporary conference tables, and more to fit any office need. All meet or exceed government sustainability requirements, too. To shop Hahn Direct, go to gsaadvantage.gov and type Hahn's contract number 27F, like furniture, 0015S, like Sam, in the search bar. That's 27F0015S. When you need office furniture, GSA Advantage is a quick, safe way to buy online, and Hahn lets you stretch your budget without compromising quality or style. Buy Hahn Direct. Go to gsaadvantage.gov and search contract 27F0015S today. Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show, Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Visit myvillagegreen.com. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Zymogen and Metagenics.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
AT&T's commitment is clear. That's why we're announcing that with the planned merger with T-Mobile, AT&T will begin bringing 5,000 jobs to America from overseas. We will invest $8 billion more and deploy the next generation of wireless broadband to nearly everyone in America. This investment will create as many as 96,000 American jobs. We're ready to invest in America. AT&T.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
Tradition never graduates. Come spend a day in Annapolis with your family, friends, and Navy football. See the midshipmen in their homecoming game versus the East Carolina Pirates, Saturday, October 22nd at 3:30 p.m. at Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium, presented by Verizon Wireless. Join us and experience a game day atmosphere like no other. Buy your tickets today for the Navy homecoming game and see the Mids take on East Carolina October 22nd at 3:30 p.m. Get the best seats now by calling 1-800-US-4-NAVY or by logging on to NavySports.com.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on Federal News Radio at 10 a.m. Please join me this week for my special guest and partner, John Dedon, trusts and estates expert at Odin Feldman & Pittleman. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by the full-service law firm of Odin Feldman & Pittleman, located in Fairfax and serving the entire D.C. metro area. If you'd like to know more about us, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
This is John Gilroy from Federal Tech Talk. You know, I've done over 200 interviews here on Federal News Radio, but many listeners still ask, yes, John, but what does your company do? Well, my company is called Armature. For the past decade, we have worked with organizations to help improve the way they collect data. You may call it comprehensive data collection, data analysis, or even outcomes measurements. If your agency has any problems with collecting, analyzing, or displaying data, then please visit our website at armaturecorp.com. We can help.
Much of the world's energy usage goes toward heating or cooling our buildings, but that could change if engineers are successful at making the perfect insulator. The heat that warms your home travels like sound as waves.
They tend to penetrate everything. They propagate around. They hit things. They exchange their energy with the walls.
And then get released outside, says Ned Thomas, engineering dean at Rice University. So he's designing material with microscopic openings that precisely match heat wavelengths and cause them to get reflected backwards. Then
you might be able to keep the home pretty warm just with your own internal energy.
That's right, body heat.
Now, it's a matter of figuring out the best set of materials and the best manufacturing processes to do these things
in a sturdy, cost-effective way. To find out more about this and other engineering innovation stories, go to www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we've been talking about Congress and what's going on up there, and you know, the budget, wartime contracting commission. Now we're going to turn a little bit to the DoD authorization bill, John. And you know, I guess the basic easy question: what from your perspective, what are you seeing as some of the key acquisition provisions there?
Well, I think the first thing we need to look at is where we are in the process. The House reported their bill.
Thank you for correcting my question.
No, well, no,
it's okay.
I'll answer your question. But
no,
I appreciate it. I'm going to frame it a little bit first. The House has already passed their bill. I mean, they got it out of committee in May, got to the floor before the Memorial Day recess, so they're essentially done. The Senate did their markup in early June and reported their bill out by mid-June, and they're still waiting to go to the floor. They're in a very similar situation to what happened to them last year, which is that they actually waited quite a while to go to the floor. They finally got to the floor, and they couldn't overcome the hurdles to continue floor consideration, so the leader pulled the bill, and they never actually finished the consideration of the bill on the floor. Now, for the authorizing committee like the Senate Armed Services Committee, that is a huge blow to their ability to have influence, because they have a lot of different pieces of the authorization bill, some of which deal with funding, authorization levels. There are a number of policy issues in the acquisition space, but there isn't a necessity, basically, to have an authorization bill. So they are really banking on getting the bill through as a way of maintaining their influence over the overall policy and spending in the Department of Defense. So if they don't get a bill through the floor this year, this will be the second year in a row that they weren't successful in doing that, even though last year they did get a final bill that Congress approved. The Senate never got their process completed. So That's sort of the background and the context to this. Right now, they're waiting to go to the floor.
And the authorization bill sort of just sets the parameters of what people
right.
are going to do or not
right.
do.
Right.
Congress here, you can do these things.
Right. But GAO basically has ruled that at least on the spending side, if you have an appropriations bill for defense without an authorization bill, that's fine. That constitutes a de facto authorization. So they don't have that necessity in the budget process to actually have an authorization bill. And as a result, they're one of the few committees. Most of the other authorization committees haven't put out authorization bills for years. And they're one of the few that basically have maintained that process throughout. So they're going to be very desirous of getting that bill to the floor. Now, right now, there is a holdup, because there's language in there basically limiting what the administration can do with the Guantanamo detainees. The president has threatened to veto the bill informally, I guess. They haven't come out with their statement of administration policy yet. But
So, John, that sort of detainee language is like a compromise.
Right. It's bipartisan. It's bipartisan within the committee. And Majority Leader Reid said he's not going to bring the bill up with that language in it. So the committee basically has to figure out what they're going to do in response to that before the bill can even be brought up for consideration. The other problem that you have with the bill is that it takes a minimum of 1 week and normally at least 2 weeks because of all the amendments that normally come up on the Senate side. And so finding that two-week window when you can bring the bill up and debate it in the current climate is going to be very difficult. But I'm assuming that at some point that bill does come to the floor. The issues that are currently pending in the bill, there are a couple of them that are pretty interesting. One has to do with the depot maintenance and the whole depot system and the degree to which the department will report in a different way about the activities there, what things will be considered depot maintenance for purposes of use of funding. It's a little bit of an in-the-weeds issue. But ultimately, a lot of the process that this discussion will start, and this language is now in the House bill, is really starting to answer the question of, as we go forward in this very austere budget environment, what will be the relationship between the industry and the organic capability within the services and the Department of Defense to do depot level maintenance and repair on as we look at the budgets going down in the future.
And is it sort of like, would it be fair, it's sort of like a canary in the coal mine? It's
yes.
like a kind of indicator where things may be headed?
Right, right. I'm not sure any of the language gets adopted this year. There have been a lot of discussions around it.
Well, what does it do?
Well, essentially what it would do is it would broaden the definitions of depot-level maintenance and repair and basically eliminate the current exclusions that are in the law. And by doing so, what it would do, it would potentially subject more of the dollars that are currently being flowing into the depots or flowing into the general area of maintenance and repair to the 50-50 rule. Which basically says that 50% of the contracted dollars in each fiscal year have to be put into the organic depots. And right now, the Air Force in particular really has a problem with this because as a result of their analysis at the end of each fiscal year, they've had a practice of pulling work, artificially pulling it really arbitrarily, into the depots in order to make their 50-50 numbers, which causes a lot of disruption on the maintenance side in general and obviously a lot of disruption on the industry side if you're at the receiving end of one of those actions. And so the question is, what do we do going forward, which provides for a more stable framework for government and industry to work together. So I think that's one of the issues. The other things that the language would do would basically provide a different framework for public-private partnerships within the depots, and people are looking at that as well. So we'll see what kind of model emerges or if the discussions become so politically charged that we can't make any progress with it. But that's one of the issues that's out there right now. I would just mention another one that also is an interest. And that's the status of intellectual property rights in government contracting. Last year in the authorization bill, there was a Section 824, which essentially said if, as a contractor, the only contribution that you were making to the development of an item or process was through government-funded independent research and development, if there were no other dollars involved,
right,
essentially the government would get unlimited rights, which is a huge change from the framework around data rights that we've had, you know, for a long time. And really throws into question a lot of the public policy approaches to that. This year, the Senate has essentially backed off in their bill from that language from last year, but at the same time, they've tried to use independent research and development funding as some sort of an indicator on how data rights should be allocated between government and industry. There's a lot of discussion going on about that, and I think we'll have some resolution of that before the
So unlimited rights, that essentially means, you know, the government gets to do with it whatever it chooses.
They want,
give it to other people,
correct,
to use,
whatever,
give it,
whatever
produce,
they, right,
anything.
Anything, right.
And the issue there is the balance of you know, sort of an economic incentive.
Right.
On the part of a contractor to develop something when, yeah, they'll get paid for it, but there's no, you know, an essentially return, for lack of,
well,
right?
And essentially on
that intellectual exercise, right?
Under independent research and development, the industry essentially loans the government money. I mean, they basically make the investment up front, and then eventually they get paid for it down the road, but essentially it's an opportunity cost for them, and they end up having to carry that for however many years until they actually get fully reimbursed for it. So that's been an effective mechanism in many ways for development of items and processes, and it actually is much less expensive for the government because that is an overhead charge that doesn't have any additional load on top of it. So it actually works better for the government. And the question is, what incentive does industry have, and if that isn't changed, to do anything further with it? So that's being worked out now, and I think we'll get that issue resolved.
Okay. Well, right now we have to buy another ad, John, so we have to take our last break. So we'll take a break right now, but when we return, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton Associates and talking about the Hill and what's going on up there, particularly focused on acquisition. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
The Federal Broadband Minute, provided by Hughes.
Can your network save your agency money and still deliver bandwidth efficient service? The answer is yes, and the savings are at the field office. Here's how. Don't pay for high-cost dedicated access lines and MPLS ports for field office connectivity. Instead, call Hughes and get an affordable managed broadband service. The benefits are huge. By replacing costly special access with affordable broadband, Hughes can save your agency up to $300 per month per site. Multiply that by all your field offices and see the savings take off. Or maybe you think your network should provide better service for the cost of what you already pay. Whether it's more savings or better quality, Hughes National Managed Broadband Service is the answer. And get a PathDiverse backup solution for the same price as your primary network alone. Enable your government field office of the future from Hughes.
Visit government.hughes.com/WFED.
Government personnel must continue to achieve mission-critical objectives no matter their work environment. Video conferencing technologies provide a highly effective collaboration solution for federal employees affected by budget cuts, BRAC initiatives, and telework mandates if they are secure based on open standards and deployable in limited bandwidth environments. Polycom is the first video provider to have an ultimate HD portfolio that is JITC certified, offering real-time face-to-face communication without compromising secure networks or consuming excessive bandwidth. Polycom enables government customers to collaborate over voice and video anywhere, anytime, securely both inside and outside the firewall, offering high-definition video calls at half the bandwidth of other companies. To learn more, visit polycom.com/federal.
The Telework Center arms you with all the information you need to know about teleworking in the federal government. Go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Polycom.
And now, the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
A coalition of 21 federal unions and associations wants Congress to reject President Obama's proposed increase in employee retirement contributions because they're already dealing with pay freezes and program budget cuts. The coalition tells the supercommittee feds have sacrificed enough. Now, if the supercommittee doesn't come up with the plan by Thanksgiving, or if Congress rejects it, then across-the-board cuts will kick in. I'm Amy Morris.
WEPA, a nonprofit association, has just announced another 25% premium refund. Since 1996, WEPA has returned over $58 million in premiums, and the average WEPA policyholder has received over $1,700 in refund checks. WEPA also offers life insurance at rates far less than the FEGLI program. Is it a time you considered WEPA for your family's life insurance needs? For better insurance, better prices, and better value, visit WAEPA.org. Once again, that's WAEPA.org.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has an expansive and varied mission. What is Homeland Security's acquisition strategy? How is DHS enhancing its acquisition oversight? And what is DHS doing to better manage its resources and execute its overall mission? Join host Michael Keegan on the next Business of Government Hour as he explores these questions and so much more with Dr. Nick Nyack, Chief Procurement Officer of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security.
The 12th Annual Excellence in Partnership Awards is October 26th at the Crystal Gateway Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. The Excellence in Partnership Awards honor those who have excelled at promoting partnership in government procurement. A special tribute to Mythbusters for those who embody effective communication between government and industry. Come celebrate at this special event for the government contracting community and the Multiple Award Schedules program. Register now for the Excellence in Partnership Awards at eipawards.com.
How can federal agencies drive performance in a cutback climate? What are the latest best practices for maximizing efficiency in federal programs? Join HUD Secretary Sean Donovan and hundreds of federal managers to learn how to achieve more with less at Excellence in Government, the Efficiency Imperative, on November 17th in Washington, D.C. Register today to save 35% at www.excelgov.com.
This is Mark Amtower. I've been advising contractors for almost 30 years, and when they need agency contacts, I always recommend Carroll's GovSearch. With over 350,000 contact listings and over 1,000 government organization charts, they help you find the people you need to reach in all levels of government. Give them a try. Get a free organization chart and a sample listing from their database. Contact Gordon Peel at 703-757-8228. Carroll Publishing, bringing government to you like no other.
Tired of playing catch-up with the news? Stay informed all the time with the Federal News Flash. The Federal News Flash is a daily email from Federal News Radio that will bring you the latest news and information about the federal government and the federal contracting world. Find out about exclusive stories and interviews only heard on Federal News Radio. Sign up for the Federal News Flash at federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton Associates, and we've been talking about the Hill, what's been going on up there. And John, you know, we've been going down the different, you know, issues, whether it's the budget, wartime contracting, DoD authorization, talked a little 3% withholding. Now let's talk a little Data Act, and that's the Digital Accountability and Transparency Act that was introduced in the House. I think there's an also companion, I think, in the Senate to somebody else. You know, what is that about?
Well, what it's about is to get sort of an unprecedented amount of information on the internet that people can look at about, you know, various contracting actions and some almost sort of real-time information. we're sort of in a time right now when transparency is a public good that people think essentially is a free, you know, the more of it you can get,
it's a free good.
It's a free good. The more of it you can get, the better. My concern about the Data Act, well, there are a number of different concerns, but I think that the amount of information that folks are basically reaching for, and the real lack of any sort of assessment of what really is important for the public, what's really important for people in the management side of the government to really know and understand on a real-time basis, to try to adjust that, it really concerns me a lot. There's also a lot of information, or a lot of concern about how do you process the information, how do you filter it to make sure that proprietary, sensitive, you know, competitive sensitive information is protected. That's got to be the job of many, many, many people, given the volume of information that this act would require. So I think that it is reported out of committee. I don't know what the likelihood of that actually becoming law. I rather suspect it won't be acted on this year, but I think that it is a reflection to me of this general attitude that information should be free and the more of it we can get, the better. And I think we really need to start challenging that a little bit.
Well, you know, one of the things, like when you, I mean, I just, from my, you know, it seems to me you should, you know, you're asking for information, there's got to be a business reason for it, right? And I think we've lost sight of that. I mean, it's the idea, it's good to get the information and it's good to be transparent, but what are you really using the information for? Does it make sense? And is there a cost, frankly, a benefit to the taxpayer for collecting that information that makes sense? And especially now with the way the budgets are going, you know, it costs industry money to do these things and report these things and create systems and all that sort of thing. And who ultimately, you know, is paying?
Right.
It's ultimately the taxpayers paying all that. No matter what anybody tells you, that's the case. So,
well, I think, too, go back to our experience on the CERA panel. We had all the various working groups that brought their recommendations to the full committee.
Yeah.
And often in our recommendations, one of the recommendations was get more data on X.
Right,
you know,
right.
And if you added all that up, you know, we had to sort of reconcile all that, recognizing that this capacity to gather more data was not unlimited.
Right.
So there has to be some, again, you have so many people with so much time and attention. What is it that you want them to do? What is it that you want them to focus on? And I think a lot of the transparency discussion really hasn't gotten into the necessity and really focused on what the needs are.
Right. What is the return on collecting that data fundamentally?
Exactly.
Nobody's asking that question. And also, I think, as I understand the act, it also includes a new, what is it? It's called it's a GAT board or something. It's a government oversight and transparency board that would have essentially IG, all the IGs from the various agencies, and no contracting professionals, to the best I can tell.
Right.
And plus subpoena power. So that's kind of interesting things there. You know, and you mentioned the CERA panel, John, and so why don't we turn to just sort of big picture discussion a little bit. And, you know, just since, you know, 9/11, you know, over the course of the last decade, you know, there's been so many different, you know, and you sort of, to me, it's sort of like a ripple effect of things that happen, and they are connected. You know, you go from 9/11 to Afghanistan, and you know, and then there's Iraq, and you know, when you think in the acquisition world, you know, do you have thoughts about how things have changed and what, from your perspective, some of the biggest changes or concerns? I know it's a pretty open-ended question, but
well,
we can start.
I can give you, you know, my thoughts. I mean, I go back to the time in the mid-1990s when we saw the passage of the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act and the Clinger-Cohen bills and things like that, where the real desire was to try to open the system up to more commercial items, commercial-like processes. And also in the course of that, there was a development of, you know, I guess what I would consider to be the sort of the partnership paradigm with industry and government agencies, where folks were supposedly trying to work together a little bit more closely than they had in the past. And I think we've essentially gone full circle from that. I think now there's much more, based on a lot of different audits and studies and reports and things like that, especially that came out after 9/11, I think people are questioning a lot of that. And what we're seeing now is sort of the exact opposite. A lot more focus on process integrity. That's, I would say, is probably the highest of the various priorities that people have embedded in a lot of the legislation and these new ideas. The no partnership is out. I think everybody now is much more interested in arm's length relationships, things less long term, more, you know, basically shorter term procurements. We're not going to be sort of tied to one supplier or one way of doing things. Again, maybe for reasons that are perfectly fine, but it's a different model. And I think one of the things that we're going to see, and we're starting to see it now just in the discussion over the last year, is in addition to process integrity, another consideration is really starting to rise up, and that is affordability, both in the types of things that we choose to buy, but I also think it's going to have an impact on the way we buy things and the processes that we can afford to support in order to do that. So I think there's going to have to be some adjustment in expectations and priorities as we go forward. But I would say we've really seen the pendulum swing, you know, pretty far from one side to the other just over the last 15 years.
Are there other areas where you see, is it a question of trust between government and industry?
I think that's always an issue. And right now, I think we're probably at a low point with that. I mean, I really see the, when I look at things like the DoD Better Buying Power Initiative, I see things there. It's again, sort of getting a much more arm's length relationship, shorter term relationships between the contractors and the agencies for various requirements. In other words, we're not going to have a 5 or 10 year contract.
It's two to three years,
yeah. And we're going to do more frequent recompetes, and we're going to force competitions rather than having anything that looks like a sole source kind of an approach.
And you know, John, you know what the problem with that is? I mean, it's a management challenge, right?
Exactly.
Because as you said before, and I agree, there's only so many people, so much time, and many, many tasks to do. And the more, you know, the pressure on the system in terms of going to be doing more and more procurements more often, I think you could find that becoming counterproductive over time.
Similarly, when you're doing more fixed price types of things, that takes a lot more emphasis on developing good requirements to get good contracts through that process. And again, that probably is something that needs to be done in the right cases. But the question is, you know, how much can the workforce support of all these different things as you're working them simultaneously?
Right, and the problem with the government workforce is right now, the challenge, I guess, rather, let me rephrase, but it's a challenge is the ability to actually write those requirements.
Right.
I just don't think it's there. I mean, it was there at one time, but with the cuts in the 90s, primarily to me, when I was in government, a lot of that expertise was lost.
Well, and the cuts are now even going, if you look, and I look a lot at the Department of Defense, they're attempting to protect the acquisition workforce in the midst of all the reductions. But the cuts that they're imposing on the headquarters staffs and some of the other folks, that's where the requirements come from. So you're actually now putting yourself in an even more difficult position.
Right.
So, I think the other issue that I think we're really going to have to worry about is timeliness. Because appropriations, you have money that you can only use for a certain period of time and then you lose it.
Right.
We have delays in getting the appropriations passed, as we've seen in the last year. And we don't really have good streamlined vehicles anymore. I mean, we have, the schedules are still there. There are a number of other vehicles. But, for example, IDIQs, in the way that now that they have to be managed and operated with task order competition requirements, fair opportunity to compete. You have protests now on task orders above $10 million and other kinds of things. We are losing a lot of that streamlined capability, maybe for good reason, but the real question is how do you ensure that you can do more streamlined acquisition where it's appropriate to do it when you don't really have vehicles now that lend themselves to that and the current appropriation user to lose it.
Right. Well, I have to streamline. Actually, I have to cut this conversation because we've reached the end of the show. And John has some really interesting thoughts regarding procurement in the last 10 years. And John will be joining me on a panel at the Coalition for Government Procurement's Fall Conference on October 27th. Well, our panel is actually going to talk about procurement in a post-9/11 world. If you want information about the event, go to the Coalition for Government Procurement's website and take a look there. It's cgp.org. John, thank you for being on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And this is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition of Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.